class, I think you should consider that same amendment right there.
Oh, I was just tracking what Sheriff Burse was saying.
Committee?
Yeah, but that is coming out.
Mr. Chairman, I just, I was trying to read, this looks confusing to me. Line 37 says that this section does not prohibit a minor child from possessing a firearm other than, you know, in sub A, other than a handgun that was given to the child by the child's parents or guardian, which sounds to me like this does not prohibit a minor child from possessing a firearm other than the one that was given to him by his parents. Does that read that? That's not what we're trying to say, is it?
See if what the panel has to say.
It's not clear.
This is page 14, 30, page, line 37 through 40.
Why don't you put in the affirmative and then we can...
And how does that...
How does it...
How does that relate to lines 24
and 25? How about this section does allow a minor child to possess, and then let's get it that way, because if there's too many double negatives in there...
The reason for that is because there are parents that will give as a gift, okay, and we didn't want to prohibit that.
I think this does, though.
I think it does, too, despite 37 through 39.
If you look at 37 through 39, it says, this section does not prohibit a minor child from possessing a firearm, and then on line 39 it says, other than a handgun given to him by his parents. So it's like they could possess one unless it was given to them by their parents.
Mm-hmm. So if the sister gave it to him... Or their uncle.
You're right.
And I guess the question is your intent to prohibit a minor child from having a handgun, but a minor child can have other guns given to him or her by his parents? Is that the intent? Or is the intent...
Chairman, Representative Clark, that's correct.
Okay.
One additional point, and we might add in there, possible, is that the parent could be a person disqualified from transferring, and that might be added in there to preclude those individuals.
Council can fix that for us.
Okay, so the intent is it's okay if the parents have given it to them and the child doesn't have the problems that was raised in the Clackamas County letter, and the parent is allowed to possess it and transfer it.
Chairman Representative Bryan, that's correct.
Taking good notes.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bryan. Questions on Section 13? Any other comments on this section? Let's go on into Section 13A.
You might want to raise it. I don't
Mr.
Know.
Chairman, John Nichols again. This is the section that prohibits a person from having a machine gun, short barrel rifle, short barrel shotgun, or firearm suppressor, which is not registered as required under federal law. It raises the penalty to a Class B felony, which is equivalent to the federal crime of unregistered possession, and allows the state to prosecute where the federals don't.
Colleagues to my left are still working over the last section here.
Yeah, I guess
it's what they're saying is that it's illegal to have a hand.
Yeah, it's not done well. We screwed up on
this. Let me just ask the question for the record so that we have it on. Given the language in lines 37 through or 38 through 40, which at least I understand now, even though it's not clear, I understand what you're trying to do. What does that do to lines 24 and 25?
Mr. Chairman.
What's the intent of the panel? Is it it's okay for a kid to have a rifle or shotgun if it was given to him or her by his or her parents, but not otherwise? Is that the intent of the panel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, I believe that conforms with the federal rulings on the subject that a parent can give a minor child a firearm even though the minor child is forbidden to go out and possess the or purchase the gun on his own.
Okay.
If I might, just a point of clarification, and forgive me, my problem with the language here. Does this mean, John? Does this mean that the if a father wants to give his son, for instance, or a mother wants to give her daughter a handgun that was owned by the father who died or whatnot as a commemorative or for his thing, that is to be allowed? That is correct. So we're not saying that the parent may indeed give the child a handgun, although he's prohibited going out and purchasing. Thank you. That's what we thought. Good.
Clarify this.
The language is poorly put together. That's the problem.
I just want to make sure what the intent is before we start fooling with the language, because that's
Mr. Kevin Marshall's comment just confused me, but I'll figure it out.
Okay.
Thank you.
A child cannot have person cannot have a handgun if they're under 21 or a rifle if they're under 18 unless the parent gives it to them, and the parents are not prohibited from giving it to them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Let's move on. Section 13A we've touched on. Any questions on that? Section 14.
Active.
That just tells us that's nothing spectacular there. It just tells us to plug these things in. Section 15.
Mr. Chairman.
Language not in bold print.
New language. Who is it that made the new rules on this printing this year? Because I've noticed this in other bills, too.
If the whole section is new, it is not in bold.
In bold, right.
If it's an amendment to an existing section, it's in bold.
Last session, they didn't do it that way, did they? They did do it that way.
They've done it.
But the new section is always referenced by a prior section.
Just when you start to figure the rules out, they change them.
Read. Go ahead.
I took a crash course on that just a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
In section 16, that's 15 and 16. Let's talk about those.
Mr. Chairman, John Nichols, section 15 was added at our request. Currently, it is against the law for a ex-felon to have a handgun. We've expanded that, as we've discussed, to all firearms and added to the prohibited persons. However, it's not it's not unlawful for, even currently, for a prohibited person to attempt to buy a firearm. This means that if an ex-felon goes into a gun shop, assuming he uses his real name or the fingerprints trip him up, and the police identify him, if the gun has not been delivered to him, they can't prosecute him. Under this, they could prosecute him for attempting to buy. We had a case in Portland recently where a gentleman, and I use the term loosely, who'd been out of the Oregon State Penitentiary for about 3 days, went in and attempted to buy a gun from a gun shop, and the dealer got suspicious, and to make a long story short, the police were called and said, hey, sorry about that. He hasn't committed a crime because he hasn't actually taken possession of the firearm. So the guy essentially walked out laughing. We're attempting to remedy that.
President Brian.
I guess I would ask in line 17, how would you ever prove that a person knew? I mean, they would know if they were a felon, but you probably could never prove that they knew purchasing a firearm as a felon was against the law. See? This says if the person, knowing that the person is prohibited by state or federal law, you'd never be able to prove that. He would say, sure, I know I'm a felon, but I didn't know it was against the law for me to purchase a gun.
One is presumed to know. However,
Representative
Brian. Take that to court on a Class B felony.
I have a feeling that at least where felons are concerned, most of them have a definite idea what they legally can and cannot do, and go to great.
We're not talking logic here. We're talking law.
Right.
High burden for a prosecutor.
I guess we'll have to leave that up to legislative counsel then.
Well, I think that's a good point because it's not just your typical how do you prove knowledge question. Because you got to, it's not just that you intend to do the illegal act. You have to know that the act you're about to do is illegal because of your status as an ex-con.
Or any other classification.
So we need to get some guidance from legislative counsel on this question, I think.
That's one place to get
Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, one of the problems that we kept coming back to the central problem, how do you filter out the illegal person? And if you don't have some way of prosecuting the guy when he attempts to commit the act, and
that's fine. I think the solution.
It may be a language problem here, but we're not wedded to any specific language. But we would like to have some sort of sanction against the guy who tries.
Right, and I think the solution is. I think what they're going to tell us is the solution is to take out the statutory language about knowledge.
Not knowing.
Right. And just simply say, if you're a prohibited person and you try, then you violated this section. And then that way it's the same as, I didn't know it was against the law to break into somebody's house. Well, sorry, it is. And we're going to prosecute you under that statute. And we just deal with the knowledge question that way, just like we deal with it in any other crime. You're shaking your head.
I have no objection to that.
You're shaking your head.
You're going to run into a little bit of a problem because the expansion of the categories of individuals in this bill are going to be people are going to be who may be misdemeanants, violent misdemeanants, are going to be committing crimes when there is no knowledge that is a new prescribed category.
But again, I don't think that's any different than expanding categories in other areas of the law.
No, I think the question, and that I can discuss it with legislative counsel, is you need some sort of level of criminal intent, particularly if you're talking about a felony. I mean, and so that's the hurdle, is what's your criminal level of intent, and we can discuss it. But
if I might, Mr. Donnell gave me some language that seems to address the situation rather clearly, and I'll just read it, and then we can work it later if the committee so chooses. A person commits the crime of unlawfully attempting to purchase a firearm if the individual knows that they are prohibited by federal, state, or federal law from possessing the firearm. Unlawfully attempting to purchase a firearm is a Class C felony.
Isn't that what Section 15 says?
Yeah, I don't think that gets us
around.
That's
no different. That says knows that it's against the law. That's exactly what that section currently says.
Yeah. I still think we can solve the problem by taking knowledge.
It's more clear than what we drafted.
I don't think there's any disagreement about having the provision. I think we just need to, if Kevin were here, we'd have it fixed by now, I'm sure.
Well, we'd have three choices anyway.
Kevin, where are you? Come on.
Okay, we have anything else on these sections? Let's move on. Keep walking us through the bill and tell us about the next section.
Mr. Chairman, Major Renfro, Section 16. Deals with any person engaged in as a dealer in firearms, buying or accepting for trade a used firearm, shall enter the identification of that firearm on a prepared form and submit that to a local police agency or a sheriff if a local municipality agency is not available. And then those are checked. Eventually, that information is submitted to state police by that local police agency to be included in the study. But it makes a crime of transferring a firearm, selling a violation of the section by any person engaged in the business. So transferring a firearm is Class A misdemeanor.
Mr. Chair.
Clark.
What's the relationship between this and Section 1?
This deals, Mr. Chairman, Representative Clark, this deals specifically with used firearms.
Any other questions in this section? Move on, walk us through the next one.
Mr. Chairman, John Eccles again. Section 18 again was get tough on crime section, as Representative Mannix referred to them. It was added at our request. It's essentially the same language as was put in the by the NRA into the federal omnibus drug bill that was passed last year. It provides for enhanced penalties for use or possession of a firearm in crimes of violence or drug trafficking crimes, plus extra penalties if it's one of the more restricted type of weapons. I understand that there are some conflicts with this section, with the current law on mandatory penalties for possession of a firearm and commission of a crime. I also understand that this has been addressed by legislative counsel and is in the packet of amendments that committee counsel has.
Let's move on to the next section.
To 19 to 23, a conformance.
Mr. Chair, sections 19 through, I believe, 23 are conformance amendments to comply with other provisions of the bill.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on to the next one. We're going to have some, I know when we get to this study, we're going to have some fun talking about our little study here.
Section 23, if I might, is just a little error, yes. And I don't know if we had raised it, but a handgun is not currently covered under FFA, I don't believe. Short-barreled rifle, short-barreled shotgun, firearms, silencers, so forth are, but handgun is not.
So what you're telling us that that needs to come out?
Yeah, delete handgun from that definition.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
From that section.
Mr. Chairman, that's basically current law, and that is a current law, I believe, says pistol, revolver, or machine gun, and we changed pistol and revolver to handgun and then added short barrel rifle, short barrel shotgun, and firearm suppressor. So whatever is stylistically correct.
Do you disagree? You think it can stay in?
Pardon?
We need to work it out.
It's current law.
That's fine. So you're simply changing the phrase from pistol or revolver
right.
to handgun. Okay.
Current law expanded.
Right.
Section 24, then.
Mr. Chairman, John Eccles again. Currently, Section ORS 166-450 places gunsmiths in a very bad position because many firearms have their, although they have their serial number on the frame, they have the dealers or the manufacturer's make and model and name on the barrel. And anyone who is involved in customizing firearms and removes the barrel and replaces it with an unmarked one is currently committing a crime under Oregon law. Essentially, this is intended to solve that problem by taking out the name of manufacturer, model, and other markings of identification, substituting the phrase identification number of the firearm that appears on the frame. So it, under this section, it would be a crime to alter the serial number, but not to necessarily remove the manufacturer's name, because it's fairly obvious from the model of the firearm.
Chairman? Brian?
I think we had some prior testimony on this section. One of the questions that was raised was that without the maker or model, that an identification number by itself may not mean anything. I mean, you just have a series of numbers. You can't reference it to a maker model. Whether that would create an identification tracing problem.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bryan, I agree with that. However, that's a problem with the manufacturing system and the custom gunsmith market. Replacement barrels and for automatic slides quite often are not marked or have other markings than the original manufacturer of the firearm. And if you remove that, they're currently creating a crime. And
okay, Mr. Chairman, if I, are there times then when I guess a manufacturer or a what do you call them, a gun?
Custom guns.
Custom guns would put an identification number on a piece.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ryan, normally he just leaves the original marking that is on the receiver on the gun. Sometimes he stamps his own name and address on the piece in some out of the way place, but it's not standard procedure.
There was a gunsmith who had raised a concern that when he went to put the identification number on, made a mistake, he couldn't obliterate it and start over. Is that just something that we should not worry about, or is that?
Representative Baum, Mr. Chairman, Oh, Mr. Bryan, I should get my glasses on. My apologies. We have the same question. Federal law does currently allow for damaged firearms, and the word changes. There is a question that has been raised by our legal staff as well. Alters, removes, or obliterates is the correct terminology that we think should remain. Changes we think can be deleted to remove any confusion about the addition of new serial numbers on, or even identification numbers, whether it's a personalized identification number. I've seen some firearms that have SAM1, SAM2. They're added on to firearms that may not have had serial numbers before that are added on for identification purposes, SAM being the fellow's first name. So that does, that would, I think, raise some problems with the word change. However, deletion of change and retention of alters, removes, or obliterates conforms with the federal law, and I think covers the concerns that your constituent may have raised and our legal counsel may have raised.
Comments?
Major, do you have Chairman, I would note that if you will permit them to change the serial number, then you've lost all hope of identifying a firearm.
No, alters is covered there.
Page 18, section 24.
Conformance, primarily for conformance reasons. 25 to 28.
Mr. Chairman, John Nichols again. Section 25. It was the consensus of the committee that antique firearms and reproductions thereof, which do not use fixed ammunition, should conform with the requirements of federal law, which means essentially they're not covered as normal firearms. Currently, under Oregon law, antique handguns and reproductions thereof have to have all the paperwork done and wait the appropriate waiting period. It's our opinion that they should be treated as they are by federal law and essentially as curios and not regulated. We did that in our definition of handgun, limiting it to fixed ammunition, but apparently this is, there may be some conflict with this, and I'm not quite sure what. I was called by a member of the National Muzzle Loading Rifle Association who said that while we were clearing up the situation regarding handguns, we'd done nothing about muzzle-loading rifles to bring them into the same curio category.
You suggest that we say firearms instead of handguns? Because it says incapable of use as such, so...
But, Representative Mannix, most of the reproductions are capable of being used as firearms. This simply refers to inoperative antiques. Whereas federal law, if it's a black powder gun that's loaded from the front end as opposed to having a cartridge put in the breech, it's not considered a firearm. And I personally do not know of any crimes that have been committed with muzzle loaders in the last, 60, 80, 100 years.
Can you repeat your concern regarding muzzle loaders? Keep them out, or?
We would like to keep them out of the firearm statutes and treat them as curios, as federal law does. And we essentially did that with handguns, but ignored muzzle-loading rifles and shotguns for some reason as a drafting oversight.
We need to fix that in terms of drafting, then.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Bannick.
This will take care of Representative Dwyer's concern about the hunters, because if you're a felon and you're a hunter, well, then you can use a muzzle loader to go hunting.
That's essentially correct.
Just a whimsical comment, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Mannix.
Moving right along.
Thanks for the interpretation.
Let's make a note and not forget to make certain that we. I have some good friends that are.
We want to keep those.
Well, is there any problem from the law enforcement community with doing that following the federal pattern?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mannix, not from the state police standpoint, we just don't see that many crimes committed with that type of
Sure. Mr. Nichols, can you provide us with some of that language from the Federal Firearms Act? Or I guess our own counsel can get that. Thank you.
Okay, let's move on into
Section 26, you may need legislative counsel to explain. I don't know what that does.
Section 26, counsel doesn't even understand it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Virginia Vanderbilt, Office of Legislative Counsel. Section 26 basically was amended. Currently, you can sell certain long guns to kids who are 14 years of age and over. This bill prohibits the sale of long guns to, you know, people who are under 18 years, and it, you know, forbids possession with the limited exceptions of parents and guardians. So this section basically just takes out the language that deals with the sale of firearms because it's dealt with in other places.
So you're saying it's conformity necessitated by section whatever.
Right.
So it's 27 and 28.
Yeah, okay.
May I, Mr. Chairman?
Who's in Maddox?
This seems to relate also that this is a provision in the law that deals with someone who comes up with devices to use with, say, cherry bombs and combining different explosive devices, firecrackers are intensifying.
I think that's correct. The rest of the language that's staying in deals with, I mean, I don't even know what all of these devices would be, but those sorts of things.
Okay. This says it's okay to give kids small firecrackers, but not big firecrackers.
Yep. Before, it used to say it was okay.
Is that what 10 grams is, Captain's?
grins. 10 grains is probably about what you'd find in a roll of caps.
That's what our cap expert is saying over here.
My gun, my child's gun. No.
Thank you.
That's clear enough. Thank you.
Let's not get into
27
it.
Is conformance.
27 is all conformance?
That's the RICO statute, if I'm not mistaken. Am I right?
Okay. 28 is conformance.
Is there getting the forfeiture in this bill, too? That's all we need.
Depends.
There already is forfeiture.
28 is conformance, and 29 is the study.
Right.
29 and 30 is the study.
Okay, the study. Here's kind of where we're at now.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, and let me kind of reiterate why the study, so that you have it in context of where you're at. Originally, there was a desire by some of us to place a waiting period on all firearms. Placing a waiting period on all firearms was not a given. That was taken off the table. Then a desire of a waiting period for military assault weapons, getting to the issue of the Uzi and the AKS's 47s, that was not a given because of the difficulty in separating semi-automatics that may act, look, act like assault weapons, but really aren't. And the compromise that came from the gun interests to do a study for a lot of reasons. And the study then is as described, and it was written by the gun lobby in Section 29 and 30 as a compromise for a waiting period. And I have said publicly that if you had a study at the time Purdy purchased his AK-47, it took him 5 months before he used it, he would have been caught. Not that there was a waiting period, but that the information would be there for criminal and mental health checkup. So that was the reason for the study. The issue of fingerprints have come up on the study, and I'm sure that's one of the issues you're going to want to discuss with this group. But the study is a very important piece of this whole package. A, for a database. B, the gun interests will come back to you, as well as the law enforcement interests come back to you next year and tell you, we've got a problem in Oregon, or we don't have a problem in Oregon. Both groups are interested in seeing that information.
Mr. Chairman, the National Rifle Association supports the concept of the study, although I'd make one correction. I've heard it mentioned several times relative to Patrick Purdy, and I'd point out that Patrick Purdy was not prohibited
because they can be forged or altered or easily obtained, including Social Security numbers. One is the federal government document, the other, of course, is a state document. I think law enforcement would be very comfortable if they had faith in DMV or the Department of Motor Vehicles system.
Shocked.
We do not have today. And so you are going to have to strengthen that, because the key to this study, the legitimacy of this study, is the accurate identification of the individual. And the only way you can do that today is with fingerprints. Now, if you want to accept an error rate, then we can live with less positive identification, but you need to recognize that up front.
I understand that.
Are there any other items that you would be able to add to what I call the menu?
Representative Mannix, the only thing that I can say, I guess I don't have authority to do it, but currently for issuing concealed weapons license in my county, I require birth certificates, and I get them. And I've got 1,200 permits out. So it's no problem. I have a lot of faith in that. I think Dave has an opinion about those documents. Obviously, they can be forged or obtained. There's no question about it. But you can check those documents. You can go back.
Can we step back for a moment, though? Why would a felon bother to forge documents in order to apply to wait 15 days to get a weapon when he can go behind a tavern somewhere and pay someone a little higher price but make sure he doesn't have to turn in any information? At some point, are we creating such a hurdle, or is it again, you're just trying to identify that individual very carefully?
That's what I'm trying to do. Any system can be breached. I think we all have to.
Someday we're going to do laser readings of the iris, go into any gun store.
But DNA also is down to identical twins. The exception of identical twins is identical.
No, that's exactly what I was going to suggest. Were there any other issues other than the thumbprint on the long guns on this section, so that we could identify those before we move on?
I think that's it, really.
Right. And 30 is basically just a reporting requirement.
How long have we studied before?
Chair.
Oh, we could.
Yeah, there's one over here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This may not be worth it in the short term here, the first 2 years. I don't know, but I had been inquiring about how to organize the disposal of weapons that have been confiscated and so forth in a way that met all the requirements and yet generated money to help pay for the study. I know Multnomah County and I think Portland Police have an annual thing that gets the media attention where they grind them down or melt them or something. They have this annual big thing where they...
And make manhole covers out of them.
Make manhole covers, yes. Most expensive manhole covers. Several hundred thousand dollars worth. I guess what I was thinking of is if the cities and the counties, which do not want to get into the auction business, and you got to be careful on how, you know, who you sell them to, whether there was a way to, the sheriffs and chiefs would be interested in funneling those to the state police to have one organized, proper auction of some kind or bid lot or something to gun dealers and generate, I think there was an estimate, I think Major Renfro had come up with a couple hundred thousand dollars, wasn't it? And apply it to the study or in future years apply that to keeping the costs of the concealed weapon things down or whatever it is we want to use it for.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bryan, that's correct. We did a study on how many firearms are seized by the department during a one-year period between January 1st, 1987 and December 31st, 1988. There's over 2,000 weapons seized. We calculated that into man hours and so forth, destruction of certain weapons and preparations for selling mm-hmm. weapons and so forth. It was offset, that cost was offset quite a bit by personnel that would be required to run the program. But there is a possibility that there could be revenue generated that would assist in this program through forfeited weapons.
Counsel saying that maybe part of the study information could be to identify how many weapons cities and counties and OSP better handle and whether that would be something we need to pursue in the future rather than, I mean, it has to net something else, it's not worth it. And I'm not sure, I don't know if cities and counties would be willing to just pass these on because some of them do have their own auctions and stuff. So,
yeah. One other option that could be included in there was just contracting, allowing people to bid for the right to collect all of those weapons and auction them and or sell them in some fashion and then and pay the state a certain percentage of the proceeds if you're worried about personnel costs and state budgeting. I'm one of those people who hates to see waste in terms of perfectly good handguns or whatever being destroyed. Some of them may even be collectibles for that matter. Probably not, but not if they've been forfeited like that. But if you had a system, are you open to that as an option too? Just saying, okay, everyone can bid, and what percentage of the take do you want to conduct sales of these? What do you think?
Chairman, Representative Mannix, I'm not opposed to that type of thing, but I'd like to defer that to some of the other law enforcement officers who probably, on the average, seize more weapons than our individual stations do.
Chairman, Representative Mannix, Sheriff Burks again. I haven't had a chance to talk to my colleagues about that issue. Representative Bryan brought that up before, but I simply haven't had a chance. I would hate to speak for the city police. I'm a little concerned about speaking for my colleagues because I don't know what they do with those weapons at this time.
I understand you wouldn't want these, for instance, homemade zip guns remarketed, but on the other hand, a lot of times very good weapons may be forfeited.
And,
I suspect there's lockers full of these guns around the state already, of good guns.
Come.
Okay,
thank you.
I think we're done.
One
second, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I would like to have the opportunity to talk to Major Renfro with regard to the costs, since if you do eliminate the fingerprinting, it may fall under a dollar amount that may not need a Ways and Means referral. But I'm not sure, and I need to sit down with him on that.
Very
I won't
good.
Make that decision without talking to him.
I want to thank everybody that came to help us and Speaker Cass today. It's been extremely helpful for us to understand the bill. And get your conceptual and other amendments ready for tomorrow. 1:30
for work session tomorrow at 1:30.
Close the work session.